button,
and we're off. Okay, this is the shiur on the book of Yecheskel, Ilu Nishmos Mefraim Shmuel ben Avram Aryeh HaKohen and Chaya Tova Bas Eliezer Mendel HaKohen. We are currently holding in the 12th chapter of Yecheskel in verse 8 and 9. After a slight interlude last week to discuss the nature of Jewish government, we are back on track with Yecheskel. Yecheskel has been told to give a demonstration to the people of Babylonia and by extension to the people of Yerushalayim about what they can expect in their near future. The idea of walking into exile carrying just the clothes on your back. And now God addresses Yecheskel, the prophet. He says to him, this is verse 8 and 9, Vayi Dvar Hashem Eli Baboker Lemar. The word of God came to me in the morning. That's the morning after the night before. So the night before he gave a demonstration of what was going to happen to the Jews in exile, particularly to the king in Yerushalayim, the king Tzidkiyahu, who we'll hear about more today. And he said, Ben Odom, verse 9, Halo Omru Elecho Beis Yisrael, Beis Hameri, Mo Ato Osa. Son of man, have not the house of Israel, that rebellious house, said to you, what on earth are you doing? In other words, referring to his demonstration of walking away into exile, have they not asked you what you are doing? So there's two real ways of understanding the language of this verse. Really, it's pretty straightforward, but it could be, this is a rhetorical question, the obvious conclusion of God is that, you know, Yecheskel is doing something very strange. He's coming out of his house, carrying the clothes on his back and walking off into exile. But there's really two ways to understand, to translate this verse 9. Either I, God speaking, I'm really not surprised that these rebellious Jews are not even interested enough in what you did to even ask what you are doing or asking you to show them what it is you're trying to portray. Or at least these rebellious Jews did ask you to explain your strange behavior. But either way, God now tells Yecheskel to give them a more detailed explanation of the demonstration. So the demonstration has taken place, and now Yecheskel has been told to do the same demonstration, but give a running commentary as to what his demonstration of going into exile actually means. Emor Aleihem, verse 10. Emor Aleihem. God said, say to the people of Babylonia, as you demonstrate going into exile, Kama Hashem Elokim. This is what God says. Hanosi Hamaso Hazeh B'Yerushalayim. This burden, this prophecy, is directed to the prince of Jerusalem, the whole base Israel, and by extension, and it concerns the whole house of Israel, Asher Heimo Pesocho, who are there in Yerushalayim. So this is all about, you need to tell them that this demonstration of exile concerns the prince in Yerushalayim, Hanosi Hamasar Hazer B'Yerushalayim. The prime focus of the word Masar is not a regular word that occurs in Yecheskel, but it is a regular word that occurs other places in Tanakh, and it almost always means a dark prophecy. Masar literally means a burden. But in the context of prophecy, it means a dark prophecy. So the language here is Hanosi Hamasar Hazeh B'Yerushalayim, that the prime focus of this prophecy concerns the prince who is in Yerushalayim, and that is the last king of Israel, or the last king of Yehuda, which is King Tzidkiyahu, and V'chol Beis Yisrael Asher Heimo Besocha. And it also concerns everyone else who happens to be living in Yerushalayim as well. And in verse 11, Emor, say to them, God instructs Yecheskel to say to the people in Babylonia, concerning the people of Yerushalayim, and particularly concerning the prince, or the king of Yerushalayim, Tzidkiyahu, Ani Mofeschem, I, Yecheskel, am your symbol, your sign, Kasher osisi kein yes Elohim. Just as I have done, just as I have demonstrated, going into exile, kein yes Elohim, yes Elohim, so will be done to them, bagola, bashvi, yelechu. Into exile, into captivity, they will go. Now, until now, everything Yechezkel has warned the Jews about and demonstrated to them with his portrayals of exile has indicated just that, exile. He's been told to carry his implements of exile on his back and walk out during the day and walk out during the night as if he was being dragged off into exile. But it's all been, the focus has all been exile. The people of Babylon and the people of Yehuda and Yerushalayim might have convinced themselves that even if, for example, even if we do have to go into exile, like the first wave of exiles that were taken to Babylonia by Nebuchadnezzar some 6 years ago, it won't be too bad. After all, the Jews that were originally taken into Babylonia, Babylonian exile 6 years earlier, remember, this is 6 years after the first wave of exiles went to Babylonia, and it's 5 years before the destruction of the temple. So the people could have argued, the people of Yerushalayim could have argued, you know, and the people of Babylonia, listen, going into exile isn't too bad. After all, the Jews that were originally taken into Babylonian exile 6 years earlier didn't fare too badly. They very quickly established a Jewish community and started to rebuild Jewish life in Babylonia. And they could have argued to themselves, okay, you know what, so we're going into exile, so it's not so terrible, we'll get into exile, we'll arrive there, there's plenty of Jews already in Babylon, there's shuls, and you know, there's kosher butchers, and there's yeshivas, and there's the schools, and everything, it's not going to be so bad. And it's because of this potential misreading of the situation that the people of Yehuda and Yerushalayim currently find themselves in. The situation that the people of Yehuda and Yerushalayim currently find themselves in is that Yechezkel is told to add something in this verse while narrating about his demonstration about going into exile. There's one extra word in this verse that has not occurred in any of the previous verses regarding exile, and the word is Bashvi. The Pasuk says, Kasher osisi kein, kein yes Elohim. Just as I have done, in other words, just Yechezkel is commanded to tell them, to commentate on what he's doing, just as you watch me doing what I'm doing, so will be done to them. In exile, bagola, bashvi, but also in into captivity, yelechu, they will go. Now the key word in this part of Yechezkel's commentary to the Jews is his use of the word bashvi, into captivity. Now, it's one thing being forced into exile. You know, exile can be good, exile can be bad. The Jewish people have suffered many exiles. Some of them start off quite well. The Babylonian exile is a great example. That's something that started off quite well and actually didn't get too bad. So much so that when the Jews were allowed to return to the land of Israel some 70 years later, at this point in time, it's 75 years into the future, the vast majority, over 90% of the Jews, didn't want to return. Exile can be bad, exile can be good, there's been good times in exile, and there's been terrible times in exile. But exile is exile. But it's quite another thing to be exiled and then be held captive, not knowing what your fate is going to be. It's one thing being sent away into another country, it's another thing being sent away into another country and finding yourself in chains, in jail. Now, this is something that Gemara is very keen on explaining to you, and something we in Judaism have got very strong views about. The ideas of Shevi, the ideas of captivity, people being held hostage, people being held in prison, and there are very strong rules. Even in the state of Israel, we've had situations, everyone who's lived here, particularly at the time of Gilad Shalit's the deal to release Gilad Shalit, will understand the debate that went on in the country, because on the one hand you've got this deep-seated part of the Jewish psyche that you're supposed to do everything to release hostages, release captives. Pidyon Shavuim. Pidyon Shavuim is a mitzvah in our Torah to release captives that is so important that the Rambam paskins, the Rambam says, halacha is, you're allowed to sell a shul, you're allowed to sell a sefer Torah in order to finance the rescue, the release of captives. On the other hand, we know with the story of Gilad Shalit, I'm not trying to make any political statement here, I'm just telling you the facts. The other argument, the argument on the other side was, if we release 1,000 known terrorists for the return of one Jewish soldier from captivity, we might be, unleashing a terrible, we might pay a very, very terrible price later on when these terrorists reoffend and kill other Jews. So that's always been a problem through Jewish history. Nevertheless, the halacha min hatorah, the biblical requirement to release, to do everything within your power to release people bashvi, as Yechezkel describes it here, people in captivity, is very powerful. And it comes before almost every other mitzvah in the Torah. Now, the Gemara in Bava Basra discusses this, particularly in the context of what Yechezkel is talking about here. And the Gemara in Bava Basra on Daf Ches, on page 8, describes the following. That the Gemara says that Rava said to Rabba Bar Mori, concerning what the rabbi said, that redeeming captives, which is called Pidyon Shavuim, again, it's a biblical requirement in Judaism, to do everything you can to redeem hostages, people in captivity. So the Gemara says it's a great mitzvah. But the Gemara says, where do we know this? How do we know this to be true? So the Gemara says, Omar Rabba Bar Mori. Rabba Bar Mori said, we learn it from a statement by Yirmiyah, the prophet Jeremiah, who was a prophet at the time of the exile into Babylonia. Yirmiyahu says that the fate of the Jews of Yerushalayim, after the Babylonians break into the city and burn it down, together with the Beit HaMikdash, together with the temple, can be described as follows. And this is a very revealing pasuk. This is a pasuk in a verse in Jeremiah, in Yirmiyahu, in chapter 15. And listen to what Yirmiyahu says, because this is, goes directly to what the message that Yechezkel is trying to portray here. This is Jeremiah. V'hayah ki yomru elecha ona netze. And it will be, if they say to you, the people of Yerushalayim, where on earth are we going to go? V'omarta olehem. God says to God says to Jeremiah, tell the people, Koma Hashem. So says God, this is the fate of Yerushalayim. Asher lamoves, lamoves. Those that are condemned to die a natural death will die a natural death. Asher lacherev, lacherev. Those destined for the sword will die by the sword. Asher larov, larov. Those destined to die by famine will die by famine. Asher lashvi, lashevi. And those destined to go into captivity will go into captivity. And so Yirmiyahu is describing the fate of the Jews of Yerushalayim. And the Gemara says, and Rabbi Yochanan says, regarding the order of that verse, that whichever punishment is written later in that verse is more severe than the one before it. And Rabbi Yochanan explains himself. The first punishment, so to speak, that Jeremiah Yirmiyahu describes is the sword, natural death. He says the sword is worse than a natural death, because death by sword mutilates the body, but a natural death does not mutilate the body. Then Yirmiyahu says that famine is worse than the sword, because one who dies of famine suffers greatly before departing from this world, but the one who dies by the sword does not suffer greatly. His suffering is over in a very short period of time. But, says Rabbi Yochanan, the last punishment described by Jeremiah, captivity, is worst of all, as it can eventually lead to all the above tragedies. Because if you're held in captivity, you can end up dying of famine, you can end up dying by the sword, by being tortured, and ultimately you can die just with the worry of what's going to happen tomorrow to you. And the point that's being made here by Yechezkel in this verse, by adding the words Bashevi, Bashvi, Yechezkel is narrating in his demonstration, telling the people that many, many people, especially the King Tzidkiyahu, who we're going to be talking about in a lot more detail later on, the king, the final king of Yehuda, Tzidkiyahu, will not only be sent into exile together with many of the Jews of Yerushalayim, but will end up as captives, incarcerated, and forever wondering and worrying what's going to happen to them tomorrow. And says the Gemara in Baba Basra, that's the worst fate of it all. Being held in captivity, not worrying and not knowing from one day to the next whether you're going to live for another day. So Yechezkel is making the point here that don't make the... I'm demonstrating to you that you're all going into exile. But don't make the mistake that you're going, like, on your holidays. You're going to, you know, visit a new country and you're going to go to the seaside. That's not what it's going to be like. It's going to be very tough. And a lot of you are going to be held in captivity. Particularly the king, as we're going to see. as we'll see now in verse 12. And as Yechezkel continues, Vahanosid, God continues telling Yechezkel, and Yechezkel continues to commentate, to tell the Jews exactly what he's doing, exactly what he's trying to portray. Vahanosi, verse 12, Vahanosi Asher B'Solchom, and the prince who is among them, El Kosef Yisor Bo'al Tov Yetze, will carry on his shoulders in the dark, at night, and exit to exile. Bakir Yachdru Lahotzibo, they will dig in the wall to exit through it. Ponov Yechasa, he will cover his face, Yan Asher Lo Yira La'ayin Huesa Oretz, in order not to be able to see the land below him with his eyes. So this is a description, a direct description here in his narration that Yechezkel is demonstrating exile, and he's narrating to the people exactly what's going to become of the last king of Yehuda, which is King Tzidkiyahu. Number one, he's going to carry out on his shoulders at night his belongings, the clothes on his back and his few meager belongings. He's going to escape at night. Bakir, they'll have to dig through the walls of Yerushalayim, and as we'll see exactly what that means, to exit, to escape the Babylonians as they break into the city. Ponov Yechasa, he'll have to cover his eyes. We'll see what that means. Yan Asher Lo Yira La'ayin Hues Oretz, he's going to cover his face in order not to be able to see the actual land, the land of Israel, with his eyes. So we'll see exactly what all this means. So the simple understanding of this verse is expressed by most of the commentators, that while Yechezkel is imitating, leaving, escaping the city of Yerushalayim at night surreptitiously by the use of secret tunnels that were cut through the walls, he's actually telling the people that he's actually imitating exactly what King Tzidkiyahu and his entourage are going to do after the Babylonians break into the city 5 years from now. Now, the Abarbanel here makes the following observation. He said, Tzidkiyahu, well, and again, we're going to have a longer discussion about Tzidkiyahu. We've discussed him briefly already in a previous year, but we're going to have a longer discussion about him. The Abarbanel makes the point here that Tzidkiyahu is going to flee from Yerushalayim wearing the clothes on his back and carrying his bare necessities on his shoulders. And he would do this in the dead of night. And he would not leave by the regular entrance or exits of the city because of fear of being captured by the Babylonians. Rather, the king and his entourage would leave via, they had pre-prepared tunnels dug through the walls of Yerushalayim for such an eventuality. They didn't believe it, that the Babylonians would ever take Yerushalayim. That's what they told the people. That was what the message of the leaders in Yerushalayim to the people of Yerushalayim. But they still took no chances, and they built tunnels. Tunnels you can actually see till today. If you go to Yerushalayim, you can see the tunnels. Tzidkiyahu's tunnel. And as he left, excuse me. Yechezkel tells them that as he left, or as he will leave, the king, ponov yechasa, he'd cover his face like a man disgraced and ashamed of the way he was escaping. In other words, leaving his own people to face the Babylonian music. And Tzidkiyahu is covering his face so he would not have to look at any of his subjects in the eye as he flees the city. So that is the that's the simple understanding of what Yechezkel is showing them here, that the fate of the king, the fate of Tzidkiyahu. And again, I should mention that the actual name Tzidkiyahu is never mentioned in the book of Yechezkel. In all the 40 odd chapters of the book of Yechezkel, even though Tzidkiyahu is the king of Yerushalayim, he's never mentioned by name. And I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, the probable reason for it is that the name Tzidkiyahu was, and remember, Yechezkel is living in Babylonia, and Tzidkiyahu became an enemy of King Nebuchadnezzar. So the name Tzidkiyahu the name of a persona non grata in Babylonia. So Yechezkel just doesn't refer to him by name; he refers to him euphemistically as the Prince of Israel. So that is the simple way of understanding this verse. This verse, but there's a lot more going on in this verse, in verse 12, than that simple interpretation from the Abarabanel. And of course, everybody agrees. All the commentators agree that this verse is talking about King Tzidkiyahu. Yechezkel specifically refers to King Tzidkiyahu as the Nasi, the prince, the leader. And rather than Melech, he doesn't refer to him as Melech, he refers to him as Nasi. And Yechezkel is making a specific point about King Tzidkiyahu's failures as a leader. In other words, he didn't act like a king. If he'd have acted like a king, maybe it wouldn't have come to this, as we're going to see shortly. The reason why he's called a Nasi, a prince and a leader, has its origins in the verse in the Torah, in Vayikra. In the fourth chapter of Vayikra, we see the leader of Israel when he turns to sin. And the Pasuk says, this is again Vayikra chapter 4, verse 22, Asher Nosi Yechata, when a leader of Israel sins. So when a leader of Israel sins, he's not called a Melech anymore. He's just called a Nasi. He's just called a leader. So it says, Asher Nasi Yechetov, when a leader of Israel sins, V'oso achas mikol mitzvah Hashem elokov asher lo sasena bishkoga v'oshe. And he unintentionally commits any of the commandments of the Torah, which may not be committed, and he incurs on himself guilt. Now, what is that verse talking about? So, Rabbeinu Bachai, in his commentary on the Torah, says like this. He says, why doesn't the Torah use the words, Im Nosi Yecheta? The verse actually says, Asher Nosi Yecheta, when the leader of Israel sins. It should have said, Im Nosi Yecheta, if a leader of Israel sins. Right, how do you know there's going to be a leader that's going to sin? But how do you know it's a certainty that the leader of Israel is going to sin? So Rabbeinu Bachai says, and this is also the opinion of Rashi, but Rashi doesn't go into quite as much depth as Rabbeinu Bachai, like to explain why is it that the Torah absolutely assumes that leaders of Israel are going to do avos, that are going to sin, and that the sins that they're going to do are going to be bishgoga v'oshem. They're going to do something that they didn't really intend to, they didn't really foresee the consequences of what they were doing. So it's considered shogeg, considered that they did the sin at least partially unintentionally, but v'oshem. Nevertheless, they're held to be guilty for what they did. So again, Rabbeinu Bachai quotes the Medrash in Vayikra, Taras Kanim, the Medrash says as follows, that according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, now Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the leader of the Jewish, was the equivalent really to Tzidkiyahu in a lot of ways. King Tzidkiyahu was the leader of the Jewish people at the time of the destruction of the first temple, the first Beis HaMikdash. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the leader of the Jewish community at the time of the destruction of the second temple. So the Medrash discusses Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And it says, according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the word Asher may be understood as Ashrei. And the way to read this pasuk is not when a leader of Israel sins and it unintentionally commits any of the commandments transgresses any of the commandments of the Torah. In other words, when the Torah says Asher nosi yechato va'asa achas mikol mitzvos Hashem Elokov Asher lo sa'aseno, we translated that verse, when a leader of Israel sins and unintentionally commits or transgresses any of the commandments of the of God, of the Torah, which may not be done, he says that's not the way to read the verse. It says, take out the word asher and exchange the word asher with the word ashrei and translate the verse as follows. Happy is the generation, ashrei, happy is the generation whose king offers a sin offering for having committed an inadvertent sin, if he is humble enough to acknowledge an error and to seek forgiveness. How much more so is he likely to repent and ask forgiveness for sins committed knowingly? In other words, the word asher should be translated as ashrei. That if you've got a leader that understands that he's done something wrong and he asks forgiveness for it, so under those situations, when a king, when a leader of Israel asks for forgiveness for himself and the whole house of Israel, and is mochel al kavodo, is got the ability to get down from his high horse and admit that he's made a mistake, then that makes God happy. That is a cause for mitigation. That is total repentance. And says the Medrash, if the people observe that their king, if the people can see that their king acknowledges his errors by offering a sin offering, coming to the Beis HaMikdash and humbling himself and offering a sin offering, how much more so will the king's subjects be encouraged to acknowledge their own mistakes and do teshuva and ask God for forgiveness. And the Medrash says the word nosi describes the highest temporal human authority. As we discussed earlier when we analyzed the construct of a Jewish government, that's what we discussed last week. The idea of a nasi, a leader, the Torah and the Tanakh will always describe a governmental, the highest governmental office, as the nasi rather than the melech. So this Medrash now quotes our verse. The Medrash says this idea is also expressed by Yechezkel, where the prophet writes, "V'hanosi asher besocham el kosev gisa," which literally means the king, meaning King Tzidkiyahu, should carry the vessels of exile on his shoulders as he escapes Yerushalayim. But the deeper meaning of these words is that the king carries the burden of responsibility of leadership on his shoulders. "V'hanosi asher besocham el kosev gisa," that there's a huge responsibility. It's not just talking about how King Tzidkiyahu is going to have to humble himself and walk off into exile after making all the mistakes that he made, but it's a statement of fact that the leadership of Israel, a leader of Israel, carries the burden of responsibility of leadership on his shoulders. And if that leader has not set the right example by admitting his own mistakes and changed his ways and publicly asked forgiveness from God, then what hope is there for his subjects to do the same? So here you have a completely different reading of this verse. When the verse says, "V'hanosi asher besolchom el kosef yisal ba'alta v'yetzei," yes, It is a message to about the future. It's a message about how Zedekiah will eventually be humbled by the Babylonians and have to run away secretly at night through tunnels and escape Yerushalayim at night and cover his eyes in shame. But it's also an expression of the importance of a leader of Israel recognizing that he's not only got responsibility for his own actions, but Vahanoti Asher Basochem Al Kosef Yisa. He carries with on his shoulders responsibility for the way his people behave. Because if a king is prepared to humble himself and admit his own mistakes, then the people themselves are more likely to do so. Whereas if the king is not prepared, he says, you know, I'm right. I'm the king and I'm right. And all the actions I took were appropriate. Then you're going to have the nation that, especially someone like King Zedekiah, a leader like King Zedekiah is very popular. Then you're going to have the people who are also, they're not going to be prepared to back down and admit what they're doing is wrong. So now, once we understand these words, Vahanosi Asher Basochem Al Kosef Yisa, that the leader of Israel carries on his shoulders the burden of responsibility, not only for himself, but the responsibility for the behavior of the rest of his nation, now we can understand explain Yechezkel's commentary here in this verse. And we're going to base it on another medrash, a medrash in Eicha, and another medrash, the Pesikta Rabosi, which is also a very old medrash. And to understand exactly the points that Yechezkel is making here, we'll refer in and out to these two midrashim, the two very dark midrashim, Eicha Rabbah and the Pesikta Rabosi. Firstly, Chazal describes King Zedekiah's main sin. Now, King Zedekiah, his main sin was not idolatry. It wasn't idolatry, he wasn't a pagan, it wasn't murder, he wasn't a murderer, and it wasn't adultery. He never got himself involved in any type of sexual impropriety, which are the three classic sins that are almost always proposed as the cause for the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. King Zedekiah himself never got involved in any of that. He wasn't an idol worshipper. He wasn't a murderer by nature. He was a very weak character, in fact. And, you know, he had his own wife and he wasn't involved in any type of inappropriate sexual activity. Rather, it was that he had the ability to protest all the evil of his generation and improve the people of his generation in meaningful ways, but failed to do so. He saw what was going on in Yerushalayim. He was very well respected. He was a very popular king. He was a very popular leader. He saw what was going on in Yerushalayim. He knew what the people were doing. He knew the people were worshipping idols, that they had a schizophrenic type of religious life. They were, on the one hand, they were practicing Jews. On the other hand, they were practicing pagans. He knew that they were getting themselves involved in all sorts of inappropriate sexual activity, but he didn't do anything about it. He never protested. He never introduced any type of legislation to stop it. Whether he failed to protest because he felt his protest would be useless or that the moment was not propitious or any of a thousand reasons is not clear. We don't know why he didn't protest. But Zedekiah was guilty of sins of omission rather than ones of commission. He failed to act when he could have done. That is the main problem, as we're going to see, with King Zedekiah. And because of his failure, the moral base of the Jews of Yerushalayim drifted further and further from its center. It got to the point that not only did many people abandon the commandment of Bris Milah, but even some Kohanim who served in the Beis HaMikdash did so without ever having been circumcised. And Zedekiah did nothing about it. Zedekiah could have protested, but he didn't. He did nothing. He just let, you know, he had this opinion that nothing's going to happen to us. and it wasn't, maybe it wasn't his place, or he wasn't strong enough, he didn't have the fortitude that is required of a leader to protest when you know he should be doing. He just didn't. He did nothing. La'enehem. Einayim lahem velo yero. He had eyes, but he just refused to see it. He didn't refuse to see it, but he refused to do anything about what he actually saw. He didn't do anything. That was his first mistake. Secondly, says the Medrash, the previous king, Yechoniah, who was the penultimate king of Yehuda, he had been taken into exile by King Nebuchadnezzar when Babylonia first conquered Yehuda. As we know, that event took place 11 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which is 6 years prior to the events being described here by Yechezkel. So it's about 6 years prior to this that Nebuchadnezzar took Yechoniah into exile, and he took with him thousands and thousands of people, as we've discussed, including the rabbis, many of the rabbis, the prophets, including Yechezkel himself, Daniel and Mordechai, and a lot of the professionals, the artisans, as we've discussed previously. After the exile, the first wave of exile, which was the exile of King Yechoniah and the thousands of upper class, so to speak, Yerushalmi, Jerusalemites, and people from Yehuda, the upper classes of Yehuda, Nebuchadnezzar, who actually had no desire at the time to destroy Yerushalayim or the Beis HaMikdash, he had no intention to destroy either. As far as the Babylonians and as far as the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar was concerned, Yerushalayim was a cash cow, like all his captured territories were. They were severely taxed, and he used them as a cash cow, money. And you don't destroy your assets. So he had no intention of destroying Yerushalayim. So he allowed Sidkiyahu to take the throne. Sidkiyahu was the uncle of Yechoniah, and again, from the Malchus Beis David, from a direct line of Beis David. His name wasn't Sidkiyahu, his name was Mataniah. And Sidkiyahu became the king. Nebuchadnezzar made a deal with him that the best thing to do, Nebuchadnezzar was quite correct, the best thing to do was have a Jewish leader, but make sure that the Jewish leader is your puppet. So Nebuchadnezzar appointed Sidkiyahu to take the throne under the condition that he not rebel against him. That's code for that the kingdom of Yehuda was effectively finished as an independent country. That the Jews were allowed, so to speak, autonomy on the basis that they answered to Babylonia, that they answered they were a vassal state, a puppet state. So the deal was struck that the people of Yehuda could stay on the land, could stay in Yehuda, could stay in Yerushalayim. They could manage their affairs and keep the Beis HaMikdash, keep the temple running. But they had to pay taxes. They had to swear allegiance to the king of Babylonia. And worst of all, do whatever the Babylonians said when it came to foreign policy. In other words, if Nebuchadnezzar went to war with another country and he demanded that Yehuda send soldiers to support the Babylonian army, they had to do so as well. Nevertheless, the agreement did allow for the retention of the Beis HaMikdash and the continuation of Jewish life in the whole of Yehuda, the southern kingdom, and most importantly, it's allowed for the continuation of Jewish life in Yerushalayim. So Tzidkiyahu, King Tzidkiyahu, Nasi Tzidkiyahu, not only accepted the Babylonian terms, but he took a vow to Nebuchadnezzar in a personal meeting with King Nebuchadnezzar not to rebel against him. And Nebuchadnezzar was by this time very well acquainted with Jewish customs and knew that Jews were loath to break a vow that were taken in God's name. And that's why he called him Tzidkiyahu, because he made a vow in God's name, and therefore Nebuchadnezzar realizing, knowing, understanding that Jews are very loath they won't take a vow in God's name unless they absolutely mean it. He called him Tzidkiyahu, someone who's tzedek, someone who's righteous in God's eyes. Tzidkiyahu. He made Tzidkiyahu make this vow in the Beis HaMikdash. As he made the vow, he was holding on to a corner of the Mizbeach, or according to another opinion, he was holding on to a Torah scroll, a Sefer Torah, and he made a vow using God's name that he would not rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, at which point Nebuchadnezzar changed his name, called him Tzidkiyahu. You, to me, you are righteous in God's eyes, and satisfied, Nebuchadnezzar withdrew and returned to Babylonia. But unfortunately, it didn't take long for Tzidkiyahu to rebel. And again, the Medrash here explained that Tzidkiyahu consulted with the Sanhedrin, and they found a legal loophole to break his vow. Exactly how they found the legal loophole is the subject of a very long Gemara, which we don't need to go into. But nevertheless, the Sanhedrin advised him that there was a legal loophole to break the vow, and which he did. And later on, Nebuchadnezzar would find out about it and take his revenge on the Sanhedrin. He'd kill every member of the Sanhedrin. But the Sanhedrin made a mistake here. They shouldn't have advised Tzidkiyahu to break his vow with Nebuchadnezzar. That's not what God wanted him to do. And in fact, the prophet Yirmiyahu was vehemently against these machinations that were going on between the king and the Sanhedrin. However, Yirmiyahu was powerless. He didn't have, as we discussed last week, the prophet does not have any legislative or executive power in Judaism. He only has the power of advice and rebuke. And the king, Tzidkiyahu, would rather listen to the Sanhedrin, and he listened to what his own head was telling him. And so Yirmiyahu was virtually powerless. And Tzidkiyahu felt that Yirmiyahu had betrayed him, because Tzidkiyahu freed Yirmiyahu from the dungeon. Yirmiyahu was in prison. The previous king, King Yechoniah, didn't like Yirmiyahu's prophecies, and he put him in prison. And it was King Tzidkiyahu that had freed him from prison. And Tzidkiyahu didn't want to listen to Yirmiyahu. He says, you don't contradict me. I'm the guy that took you out of prison. So Tzidkiyahu reigned during this period. And during this period, when Tzidkiyahu was preparing to rebel against the Babylonians, Yirmiyahu preached vehemently against Tzidkiyahu's governmental policies. He preached against the fact that he turned a blind eye to the paganism and to the sexual, sexually inappropriate behavior going on in Yerushalayim. He objected vehemently and in public to the government policies of rearmament, which they were doing in secret to rebel against the Babylonians, because Yirmiyahu's belief, which was based on what God had told him, was that the Jewish people should take a very low profile and not rebel against Babylonia, but rather they should focus all their efforts on doing teshuva. If they did teshuva, that would be the way to avert the destruction of Yerushalayim. Taking up arms against the Babylonians is going to have the opposite effect. And the general rule with prophecies of a negative nature is that they can be retracted by sincere teshuva, which is what Jeremiah was preaching. Do teshuva and retain the status quo. Don't do teshuva and rebel against the Babylonians. You're only going to bring destruction upon yourselves. It's only prophecies for good that are irreversible. In other words, prophecies that prophesy future blessing, etc., etc., the Mashiach and everything else, they are irreversible. Prophecies that describe destruction are reversible via teshuva. Consequently, even until the very end, Yirmiyahu held out hope that his worst prophecies could be averted. And that's why he preached non-stop in Yerushalayim against the attitude of King Tzidkiyahu, for number one, turning a blind eye to the behavior of the Jews, and number two, to the fact that all along, in secret, Tzidkiyahu was preparing to rebel against the Babylonians. Unfortunately, Tzidkiyahu listened only to his own advisors and to his own head, rather than to Yirmiyahu. They convinced him, as the people on the Sanhedrin, the Dayanim on the Sanhedrin, convinced him to break his vow and rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. And as we know, this rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar had disastrous consequences. Because when Tzidkiyahu initiated a rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar, he came with his army from Babylon and began the siege of Yerushalayim. And again, this is just repeating stuff that we should know already. It's either on the 9th or 10th day of Tammuz in the year 423 BCE, they breached the walls of Yerushalayim. And on exactly 1 month later, on the 9th of Av, they burnt the Beis HaMikdash to the ground, the temple to the ground. The destruction was complete. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. The Jewish world was seemingly at an end. Meanwhile, while Tzidkiyahu, back to our verse, that was the historical background. Meanwhile, while Tzidkiyahu was rearming, secretly rearming, and preparing to rebel against the Babylonians, he'd built for himself an escape tunnel. Why wouldn't he? He built a secret escape tunnel. Although in his mind he was ostensibly certain of victory and confident in his advisors and in his army, nevertheless, just in case, right? So he can't be too careful. He'd prepared the tunnel just in case they were wrong. And when it became obvious that they had been wrong, him, his sons, and his personal bodyguards, and his royal entourage, and some of his senior army officers escaped through the tunnel, with exactly as Yechezkel describes here, as his prophecy. They escaped down the tunnel with the clothes on their backs and their basic needs, as this chapter describes them, the implements of exile. But of course, Yechezkel is predicting much more than the plain facts about Tzidkiyahu's escaping. Because based on the narrative I've just discussed with you, this verse has got a far deeper and far darker meaning. So now let's go back after the historical background about King Tzidkiyahu himself and his preparations for rebellion. Remember, his two sins that the Medrash describe here, which historical events actually empirically prove, are number one, that although he didn't take part in any of the pernicious activity that was going on in Yerushalayim, nevertheless, he never objected. He never tried to stop the people of Yerushalayim in their behavior, their paganism, and their sexual immorality. He never tried to stop them. And number two, he decided against the word of God to rebel against the Babylonians, which of course is going to be the catalyst for the destruction of Yerushalayim, the actual physical catalyst. So now let's go back to this verse. It's the Novi says here, Yechezkel says here, V'hanosi asher v'socham el kosef yisob ba'alto v'yetze. And the prince who is among them will carry on his shoulders in the dark at night and exit to exile. Meaning, the Nosi, the man, King Tzidkiyahu, that the Torah describes as being the person who is required to admit his mistakes. Remember, that's how we dash in the verse. The Nosi Asher Nosi Yecheto. That the idea of a king is somebody that's supposed to admit his mistakes. As this Nosi, V'hanosi asher b'socha, that this man, this leader, who is required by the Torah to admit his mistakes, and to admit them publicly in order to set an example to the rest of the people, and also to admonish them for their own sins so that they will return to the right path, failed to do so. This is what Yechezkel is saying. The man who was responsible to change the direction in Yerushalayim failed to do so. And that's the weight he's carrying with him on his shoulders as he leaves Yerushalayim. And as a result of his negligence, this negligence, King Sidkiyahu left Yerushalayim carrying not only his own sins of omission with him as he left Yerushalayim in darkness, but he also left with the dark sins of the rest of the people on his shoulders. Al Kosef Yisar Ba'al Tov Yetze. He carried with him, as he left Yerushalayim, the remnants of his own mistakes, and he left behind the people of Yerushalayim to feel the consequences of his actions. The fact that he didn't prevent the Jewish people, he didn't confront the Jews of Yerushalayim for the sins that they were doing, and also for the fact that he instigated a rebellion against King Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king. He's leaving in the dark, and he's leaving the Jewish people, he's leaving his own subjects to face the music inside Yerushalayim. So, that regarding King Sidkiyahu's first failing, the verse says, remember the verse says, Bakir, this verse, verse 12 says, Bakir yachturu lahotzibo. They will dig in the wall to exit through it. Now, that language can be read in two ways. It can be read the simple way, true. King Sidkiyahu would escape Yerushalayim with his entourage by digging secret tunnels. But you can also read these words like this. It was King Sidkiyahu's failure to listen to the words of Yirmiyahu, to the prophet Yirmiyahu, that he shouldn't start a rebellion against the Babylonians, that persuaded Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army, after King Sidkiyahu rebelled against them, to start a siege, and eventually, Bakir Yachduru Lahotzibo, they, the Babylonians, will tunnel into the city, destroy it, burn it down, and either kill or remove all the inhabitants, thus initiating events leading to the utter destruction of Yehuda, Yerushalayim, and the temple, and the second and final wave of exile. So that's one way of reading those words. Bakir yachturu lahotzibo. Yeah, the simple meaning is, King Sidkiyahu is going to rebel, and he, you know, he's going to start a war with the Babylonians, and he's going to provide himself with a failsafe, he's going to dig a tunnel so that he can escape. But by digging a tunnel, by rebelling and digging a tunnel so that he can escape, he's creating the circumstances where the Babylonians are going to come and yachduru bakir. They're going to be digging in the wall, coming in the opposite direction, breaking into the city. And as King Sidkiyahu escapes, which he thinks he's going to escape, which of course we'll see he doesn't escape, or not for very long, while he escapes with carrying the sins of the Jewish people on his shoulders, the Jewish people are left to feel the wrath of the Babylonian army as they enter Yerushalayim, those that are not dying of famine because of the siege, those that are not been killed by the civil war that was eventually raging in Yerushalayim, those that weren't killed by the Babylonians, they will eventually be carried off into exile in chains, Bashvi, as the previous verse says. So that is the consequence of King Sidkiyahu's first failing. And regarding King Sidkiyahu's second failing, the verse concludes. Remember, the first failing was his failure to tell the people, you know, you can't be behaving like this. Eventually, the Babylonians are going to come. But he not only didn't warn them, he told them, we're going to fight back. We're going to rebel against the Babylonians. And as a result of that, the Pasuk finishes off, Yechezkel finishes off here, verse 12. Look at the words. Ponov Yechase, as King Sidkiyahu leaves Yerushalayim through his dark tunnel, the tunnel he prepared for himself. Ponov Yechase, he'll cover his face. Yan Ashelo Yira La'ayin Hu Es Ha'aretz. He'll cover his face in order not to see the land with his eyes. Meaning this. As King Sidkiyahu leaves Yerushalayim, he would suddenly realize that all of this destruction could, at the very least, have been mitigated had he acted appropriately on two fronts. If he had taken the leadership his leadership, his royal responsibilities seriously, and admitted his own mistakes publicly in order to set an example to the rest of the people, and also joining in the prophets in admonishing the people for their sins so that they'd return to the right path. He did neither of those things. That's number one. And if he'd only listened to the prophet Yirmiyahu and not rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, if he'd have done two of these things, none of this would ever have happened. So Ponov Yechaseh, he's, as Sidkiyahu leaves Yerushalayim with his entourage via his secret tunnels, he's going to finally recognize these two crucial mistakes that he has made. And as a result, says Yechezkel, Ponov Yechaseh, he's going to cover his face with shame, not even wanting to take a last look at the Holy Land. Lo Yireh La'ayin Hu Es Ha'aretz. He'll be so embarrassed, he won't even want to take a last look at the holy ground of Yerushalayim, which he now realizes he is never, ever going to see again. So this verse 12 is an indictment. It's an indictment against the king. That this idea of leaving, it's a factual account of exactly what is going to happen to Tzidkiyahu. Yes, he's going to leave. He's going to fail on two counts. He's not going to help the prophets in admonishing the people. Remember, as I said to you, unlike the prophets who were very unpopular, the king Tzidkiyahu was very popular. If he would have told the people, this is not the way to behave, he might have introduced a Baal Teshuva movement, but he didn't. And, if ifs and ands were pots and pans, right? But, and also, the second if he would have also listened to the prophets, particularly to Yirmiyahu, and not rebelled against the Babylonians, so the Babylonians probably wouldn't have come into Yerushalayim either. But all this, he did. These were the two mistakes that he made. And as a result of that, he literally will be walking out in the dark, carrying his meager possessions on his shoulders. But deeper than that, he'll be walking out carrying the burden of what he has done to the Jewish people. He didn't take his leadership, his royal responsibilities seriously enough to create the situation where the destruction of Yerushalayim and the burning down of the temple could have actually have been avoided. So that's what he's carrying out as well. Yeah, yes, he's carrying out his meager possessions, but he's carrying out with him the responsibility that he's holding on his shoulders. He's carrying that responsibility on his shoulders. And as Yechezkel said, at that point, Ponov Yechaseh, at that point he'll get the message. His eyes will suddenly be opened, but he'll deem himself to cover them in shame because he'll realize what he has done. So that is basically, that's those two midrashim, the way they understand this verse, verse 12, which is very dark, to lump all this destruction on the shoulders of one man, because the reality is the Jews have been misbehaving for hundreds and hundreds of years. But it seems that what Yechezkel is trying to demonstrate here to the Jewish people is that the straw that broke the camel's back was the behavior of King Tzidkiyahu. Like, King Tzidkiyahu had the ability to change the status quo of Yerushalayim and didn't. He turned a blind eye. A naim lohem velo yero. They've got eyes, but they just refuse to see. And secondly, he did something that he had no business doing, and that was after making a vow in the name of God not to rebel, he rebelled. And now all this is going to come back to haunt him. But more than haunting him, it's going to be the catalyst for the suffering of all the people of Yerushalayim. As we learnt the verse in Yirmiyah, some would die natural death, the lucky ones would die a natural death, some would die by the sword, some would die by famine, and some would go into exile, and some would be not only going to exile, but would go into captivity as well. So now, which is what we'll do next week, which is verse 13, which is again a hugely powerful verse describing God in action, so to speak. This is God describing himself, literally describing himself in action. He's telling you how he works. Once we know, again, the literal understanding of verse 12 is a description of how Yechezkel is going to, of how Tzidkiyahu, the last king of Yehuda, is going to escape. He's going to escape down dark tunnels and try and escape the wrath and the vengeance of King Nebuchadnezzar. In verse 12, again, which we'll do next week, we're going to see God is not going to allow King Tzidkiyahu to escape. And as I'll just read the verse to you so you can get a taste of what we're going to be discussing next week. God said, yes, since King Tzidkiyahu, he bears a tremendous responsibility for what happens, but he's going to escape down this tunnel. But God says, "Uforasti es rishti olav, I will spread my net over him, v'nitfas b'mtsudosi, and he will be caught in my trap, v'hevesi oso bovelo, and I will bring him to Babylon, Eretz Kastim, the land of Chaldea." Why it has to say that twice, we'll discuss next week. Va'oso lo yira, I'll bring him to Babylonia, but he will never see it. V'shom yomus, and there he will die. So this is the payback. What happens to Tzidkiyahu? Tzidkiyahu's got a price to pay for the sins he made. And the reality is, it's quite clear from the Psukim that he makes these sins, you know, they're inadvertent. You know, they're calls. He's making a call here. What he believes is right. That's why the Pasuk in the Torah describes this type of a Nasi making a Bishogeg. This is really inadvertent. The problem is that the effects, the tragic effects of this mistake are so powerful and so have had such consequences, long-term consequences for the Jewish people, that unfortunately Tzidkiyahu cannot get away with it, cannot be seen to have got away with these mistakes. He's carrying on his shoulders this responsibility, and that there has to be a point where God says enough, which we'll discuss, and please God, next week, when we discuss what exactly Yechezkel describing the end game of what happens to King Tzidkiyahu. Okay, that's it. That's your lot this week. I hope everyone enjoyed the shiur. Everyone should have a good week, and I'll see you all, please God, same time, same place next week. Harvey Farber, I'll see you tonight to learn some Gemara. Jeff Wilk, I'll see you tomorrow to learn some Tanakh. Who else will I see? Gila, I'll also see you tomorrow. Philip, I'll also see you tomorrow, please God. Call to everybody. Everyone have a nice evening, and we should meet again in health and happiness, same time, same place, next Monday. Call to everybody.